morning.
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 Begin the recording now. We're on wherever you are. Pleased to be with you today and this week. Talk about some favorite topics of mine, God and creation in the Old Testament. And with particular focus on what biblical resources do we have available for us in thinking about environmental issues. And we'll make our way through that topic in a variety of ways over the course of the week. Maybe to give you some sense of that. Today, what kind of God do you believe in? As we'll see, the kind of God in whom you believe will make a great deal of difference in terms of how you explore environmental issues. Tomorrow and Wednesday, one of the issues that we'll be working with has to do with, does God create the world alone? Or does God get help? Does God need help?
Yes.
God will certainly use agents in creating, and one dimension of that, of course, is the use of the human being in creative activity. On Thursday, our topic is going to be God created the world good, but not perfect. And what might it be as we struggle with the biblical evidence which suggests that that the world that God put together initially wasn't sort of a neat, finished product. It had a lot of rough edges, a lot of open ends. And suffering, as we'll see, I think, is an integral part of God's world, quite independent of sin, and would have been a part of human life even if sin had never entered the picture. On Friday, we're going to come to God and natural disasters. We have, in this country and elsewhere in our world, been living through a lot of these lately. Earthquakes, to floods, to tornadoes, to tsunamis. The Bible also talks about natural disasters in a variety of ways. The flood story, where we'll focus our attention on Friday. But then you've got Sodom and Gomorrah, which is really an ecological catastrophe. The plagues in Egypt, again, environmental disaster, again and again and again. So the Bible wants to face those kinds of issues, and how might we struggle with them, not least in relating God to them, as the text will do. So, on behalf of the bookstore, I'm supposed to mention that there is a book of mine, which is in the bookstore, which is entitled, it's a 2005 book published by Abingdon, entitled God and World in the Old Testament, : A Relational Theology of Creation. So if you want to pursue a little bit more of what I have to say here this week, I take a closer look at that book. Though in the next couple of days, I'm going to be moving beyond that book and some of my reflections. It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. The metaphors that you use to speak of God matter. They're not somehow irrelevant. And the way in which you think about God, the metaphors that you use to think your understanding of God through, will shape how you live. And will shape how you think about matters such as the environment. An illustration initially from the text on how the impact of your understanding of God, what it can have on your reflections about the environment. Just take the phrase, image of God. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, God, we are created human beings in the image of God. If you were to take a look at the scholarship of that phrase, 95% of the scholarship focuses in on image, on likeness. We're created in the image of God. And very little attention is given to the word God. Who is the God that's presented to us in the Genesis material, in whose image we are created? And to play with that is very striking. I mean, it's almost a hallelujah chorus among commentators that God created the world alone with overwhelming power, absolute control, working independently, working unilaterally, that's very common understanding of the God of the opening chapters of Genesis as well as other creation texts in the Old Testament. But if that understanding of God's work in creation is correct, and I don't think it is, we'll work on that this week, then those who are created in God's image could properly understand their role in creation in comparable terms. In terms of power over, absolute control, independence. We'd be acting like God then, right? The natural world thus becomes available for human manipulation, human exploitation. If that's the image of God with which we're working. I mean, in other words, if all the creatures of Genesis 1 and 2, say, are understood to be but passive putty in the hands of God, God micromanaging the world and absolute control of things, if that's the way it is, then doesn't that invite a comparable treatment of the creatures by those of us who are created in the image of God? How you think about God is going to make a big difference in how you think about environmental issues. Count on it. It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. Now, a little confession. My image of God has been deeply shaped by my pietistic upbringing. Norwegian Lutheran pietism in the Midwest. And my parents, my father was a pastor, my grandfather was a pastor, I grew up in a parsonage. One couple of things about that parsonage life. My parents used to parade my three younger brothers and myself into the family room every night after dinner for family devotions. And over that time, we would pray together and read the Bible together, and oftentimes it would seem to go on and on and on. But one of the things I remember is that the God to whom my parents prayed, it was as if this God were right upstairs and the walls were paper thin. This God was right there. And the language of relationship was highly characteristic of the way in which they talked about God. My Aunt Ada, who was my sponsor in baptism when she was in her late teens, she told me not too long before she died several years ago that she had prayed for me every day of my life. I quickly got my calculator out, and that was over 23,000 prayers. Did those prayers have any effect? Well, actually, it was in the wake of my aunt's death that my wife began to really believe in prayer, because she said, "Gary, since Ada died, you've been going downhill."
The next story.
I told the story in one of my classes at the seminary, and afterwards a somewhat older student, I noticed she sort of hung back and waited until everyone else was gone, and then she came up to me and she said, "Dr. Fredheim," she said, "count on it, I will take your aunt's place." a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I believe she is, so I'm surrounded by those prayers. But I think part of my academic, maybe a lot of my academic life, and my search for biblical more is a search for biblical moorings for this understanding of God. Is that pietism with which I grew up, how does it connect with the biblical material? Is there a reasonable correspondence between that perspective and the understanding of God that's present in the text? I've been working on it for a few years. I think there's a reasonable correspondence. There are some disjunctions. We can talk about that some more along the way. But it's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. If you were to if I were to invite all of you now to sort of get out your paint brushes and palette and give you all an opportunity to paint a picture of God. Now, I don't know if you think back in your art history classes, your visits through museums, are there images of God that come to mind for you that you might draw one of those? One of the images that comes to mind for me is that Michelangelo, where you get God reaching out with a finger to up to the finger of the nearly created Adam, and you get that God image there with a long beard and muscles that match Adam's. And I don't know, would we draw that forbidding if creative God of Michelangelo? Would it be some military general, maybe? Would it be the chairman of the board, maybe? Superman, Superwoman, Charles Atlas, some of us are old enough to remember that. A virile god, a macho god, a male god, like Michelangelo. Maybe it'd be a buddy-buddy god. And my God and I walk through the fields together. We walk and talk as good friends always do. Maybe that would be that kind of God we might think of. Maybe some of us would draw a picture of Jesus. And remember Jesus' statement, "The one who has seen me has seen the Father." Oh, is that how we're going to think about God? It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. There's a quote by Eberhard Jungel in his book, God is the Mystery of the World, which rings through my head often, and it runs, two sentences run like this. "The more one understands God, the more mysterious God becomes. And the deeper one penetrates the mystery of God, the more interesting God becomes." In other words, the more you know about God, the more you know you don't know. And if that's so, it would follow that the less you know about God, the less of a mystery God is. And the less interesting God is. If there's anything I hope you can take away from today, is to understand this God we have is interesting. You know, God is not demystified by further understanding somehow. You know, the more we understand, the more that divine inexhaustibility becomes apparent to us. God outdistances all of our language about God. Our images, our metaphors cannot even begin to capture God. So there's always this hiddenness of God, in all of God's ways, whether in God's revealing or in God's acting. There's going to be seeing through the glass darkly on our part, for sure. At the same time, for all that God has revealed to us supremely in Jesus Christ, I think we have not yet plumbed the depth of the reality of God. There is so much left for us to learn. There are so many texts that we really haven't gotten down deep into very well. And we can trust Jesus' promise that the Holy Spirit will continue to lead us into all the truth about God and God's ways in the world. Now, images of God, I think as I make my way out and about in the church, doing adult forums and pastoral retreats and so forth, I'm struck by the range in people's imaging of God. And all too often they tend toward a couple of extremes. On the one hand, you get sort of God as the uninvolved overseer. God sitting on the front porch of heaven, watching the world go by, maybe laughing and crying or whatever the case, but just watching. Since 9/11, I have found more people think about God in those terms. It's interesting. 9/11 seems to have been a kind of turning point. I remember I was in a congregation, it was a couple years ago now, a woman sitting about right over there raised her hand and she said, "That's right, to me God is an absentee landlord." Well, why? Give me a good reason. Why is God an absentee landlord? And she came right back and she said, "Your calls are seldom returned and nothing much gets done." And she was serious. She was serious. Now, if we don't go into that extreme, we may go to the other extreme in thinking about God, that God is an absolute monarch in total control of things, micromanaging the world. That's an image of God that's really quite common out there, too. I remember one of my colleagues gave a homily one day in chapel and talked about driving in from western Minnesota late one Saturday night, came behind the car. Car was, you know, weaving all over the road. You know, what do? You just hang back and wait, or you try to pass. And so he gets up close, and there was a bumper sticker: "God is in control." Oh, God is in control. God's got God's hands on that steering wheel. A student, in thinking through some of these matters, said in response to this, "If God is in control, then given how unruly we all are, wouldn't you have to score God a management failure?" Yeah, it'd be something like that. I think the biblical material wants to steer between the absentee landlord and the absolute monarch images of God. Or another way of thinking about these extremes is God is radically distant from us. Every prayer is like a roaming cell phone call that cuts in and out. That kind of distance, aloof. Hard to get a hold of God. On the other hand, you get kind of images of God as buddy-buddy. God takes no critical stance, speaks no prophetic word, God's never in your face. That kind of God, you know, never is heard a discouraging word and the skies are not cloudy all day kind of God. We sing only praise songs here, folks. God is a superman, superwoman, who hears our prayers and faster than a speeding bullet is able to accomplish anything or everything, right? And with such a God, no constraints are in view, no restraints are in view. The only thing falls back on whether you're sincere or not, whether you've got enough faith or not. And if your prayers aren't answered, it's your problem. You don't have enough faith. Oh, wow. You have to live with something like that in your imaging of God. How awful that is. On the other hand, we may think of God in terms of like the king or queen of England, or some of us Scandinavians, the king monarchs of Norway or Sweden or whatever. You know, not much power there, but a sympathetic presence and an ability to sponsor some elegant liturgical occasions. Now, I don't know. It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. And it'll make a difference with how you think and act with regard to the environment. Now, I think that one of the most basic images of God we have in the Bible is relationality, or relatedness. And let me begin to spin that out a little bit in terms of what that might entail in terms of thinking about relationship. I think that we all have our relationship talk when it comes to God. That I grew up with, you probably grew up with or have passed on, that we're basically concerned about your relationship with Jesus Christ, or your relationship with God, or God has a relationship with the world. And I want you to think today a little bit about that word relationship, and whether you really mean relationship Or is it something that's far, far short of what a genuine relationship really is? Now, if we go to the biblical material, there are sort of three categories of relationality, relatedness issues, that we need to attend to briefly, and some of which we'll pick up as we move along the week. First one is that relationality is basic to the very nature of God. God is a relational being. Right out of the chute, first chapter of Genesis, God said, "Let us make humankind in our image." Let us, oh us, who's the us? Now it's long been thought that, well, here we got it, the biblical introduction to the Trinity. But we can't go there. The best we can do here is we can think about this provides a kind of theological matrix within which Trinitarianism later developed. But it, here we're talking about a divine council, a divine assembly, a group of beings that surround God and do God's bidding, sort of a heavenly administrative committee or something like that. And these texts that we have, Genesis 1, you can move to Joel 1 and 2, you can Jeremiah 23, there are quite a few such texts. They testify to us of the sociality of God, the social nature of God, the relationality of God. Okay? God is a relational being, quite apart from the world, independent of the world. God is relational. God is a part of a divine community. God is a social being, community, which is rich and complex. So relationship, integral to the identity of God, independent of God's relationship with the world. Second, we'll come back to this, this kind of material probably Wednesday and work with what it means for God to use the language of us in the creation stories. God gets help. A second way of thinking about relationality is that God has established a genuine relationship with the world, and especially with Israel. Now we could begin to tick off a number of subpoints here in terms of, you know, how the text worked this through, but let's just pick off a few of them. One of the most interesting things about God is that God, very quickly in the biblical material, gives us God's own name. Naming entails a certain kind of relationship. If you know somebody's name, that's a relationship. That's different from what might be the case with people whose name you don't know. Well, God gives us that name right there. That's a desire for a certain intimacy in the relationship. It makes for greater closeness if you know the name. It makes for availability. When you pray, you don't say, hey, up there, or whatever. You got a name. And God, then by giving the name, makes God's self accessible to us, available to us. But that entails some risk for God, too, because we can misuse the name. And so we get the second commandment. But God chooses to be vulnerable for the sake of closeness in a relationship. Another way in which you could approach this relatedness matter in biblical material is to just note all the anthropomorphism talk. Anthropomorphism, that is the speaking of God in terms that are characteristic of a human being. God speaks, God acts, God thinks, God feels, God wills, God decides, God has a mouth which speaks, God has eyes which see, I mean, and so forth. That's very common language in the biblical material. And it's testimony to a God who is living, who's dynamic, whose way of relating to the world is best captured in the language of the human. And human personality, human activity, again and again. Sometimes Christians have difficulty, oh, that's just an anthropomorphism. Mm-hmm. Well, Christians should not have any trouble with that kind of language for God, because in Jesus Christ, God acted anthropomorphically in a most supreme way. Another way in which we think about this relatedness is that most of the metaphors that are used to speak of God are drawn from the sphere of interpersonal relationships, from the sphere of creation rather than from the sphere of redemption, interestingly enough. So you get God as a father and a mother, God as a spouse, God as a friend, God as the king, God as a, how do you keep God as a friend and God as a king together? Variety of human roles. You get shepherd and musician and teacher and seamstress and midwife and physician and potter and metalworker and farmer. You go on and on and on. All these images of God are profoundly personal. And then when you do get some impersonal language, like God is a fortress or God is a shield or God is a lamp, something like that, they are not understood to be impersonal. They're extensions of the persons who made them. And so they still maintain a personal character to them. And then you have the images of God in terms of the non-human creatures. These may be impersonal images for God. God is a rock. God is a mother eagle. Hosea 5, God is maggots. I like that one. God is maggots. Work with that one. There's a yes and a no to all metaphors. Yes, that's true of God. No, that's not true of God. Every metaphor has its yes and its no. Maggots have got a lot of no. Father, mother, a lot of yes. That language in Exodus 19, I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Oh, notice how relational that is. Even though it's a mother eagle. Or the rock image, I am a rock who gave you birth. Whoa, rocks give birth? How do we get there? Now, if you note these metaphors more generally, how would you characterize them there, other than their being relational and usually personal, drawn from the sphere of creation? Notice this language for God is ordinary. It's everyday. It's rather than extraordinary or dramatic. And so the language is secular language for God. Notice how secular it is. Notice how earthy it is. It's not some special spiritual language. It's very much down to earth. And so you have images for God that refuse to separate God and the world. Talk about God in terms of the world again and again and again. Ordinary. Earthly, secular. I gave a sermon at Zumbralism Church in Rochester, Minnesota several years ago. And I tried to develop the image in Psalm 96. Sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. And tried to develop the image of God as a musician. God is one who gives us new songs to sing. And so I played with that metaphor in the course of the sermon. And when I got to the back of the church after the service and was shaking hands with people as they were making their way out, afterwards I was stunned by the experience of the number of times that people on their way out made mention of their musical experience. I sing in the choir. Oh, I played the trombone. Again and again, they were connecting their own musical experience with this metaphor for God, with this image for God. And one of the problems in the church is that we have such a narrow range of images that we use for God. God is king, or God is father, and that's all the further we get. But that by using such a narrow range of images for God, what we do is we limit the capacity of these various images to truly touch people where they're at. So we need to broaden and expand our images of God in thinking about these things. The more metaphors we use for God, the truer we are to the biblical material. There are over 50 metaphors for God in the book of Psalms alone. The more we are going to connect with people's actual lives. Now, third, this relational God has created a world in which all creatures are interrelated. I think that the image of God, image of the world, excuse me, in the Old Testament is probably captured best by a spiderweb. Every part of the world is related to every other part of the world. And we're in a symbiotic relationship with every creature. And as in every act, let's say, reverberates out and affects every other creature at some level. And what is that play that, I don't know if you read it or seen it, 6 degrees of separation? Mm-hmm. That you're only, we're only six people removed from knowing everybody in the world. And people say that now with the internet, email and so forth, that's moving toward five. It's the interconnectedness. Or just think of 9/11. The number of 19 unknown Middle Eastern men affected deeply the lives of every one of us. Interconnectedness, interrelatedness. That's the nature of the world which God has created. And it's important to say that, you know, such an understanding stands over against any notion of a static world or a mechanistic world. We're going to see in the next couple days how open-ended this world is that God created. God didn't create a finished product, not by any means. And given the genuineness of these relationships, then there is this degree then of open-endedness which enables for novelty, for surprise, for wonder, for something genuinely new. At the same time, there are those constants, seed time and harvest, day and night, summer and winter. But then there's that order, and there's the play and the open-endedness in the system, complexity, the ambiguity of the creation. And one of the problems that this immediately introduces to us in thinking about God is, how does God work in this kind of world? That somehow God works faithfully in the interplay of law or order and openness and randomness. And to think about that together, God always works from within a relationship to the world. Always works from within a relationship to the world and not on the world from without. And God there, we'll talk more as we move along, but God thereby limits God's freedom, God limits God's power by virtue of taking up a certain kind of relationships to which God will be faithful come what may. Now, again, come back to this relationship. I don't think we take the word relationship seriously. If I were to come to each of you and ask you to define the word relationship as you think about God, I mean, what would we hear? I think that what we use the word relationship, say, in our relationship with one another commonly, it's spouses, friends, children, we know what relationship is then. We have experience of those relationship at varying levels there, often deep, profound levels. We know what relationship is there. And then we hear the church talk about relationship with God, and all of a sudden, that relationship with God seems so different from the relationship we have with other human beings. It seems so different the way in which the church talks about relationships. So what's going on here? It's important to say, of course, here there's always going to be some disjunction between God and our language of God, not least in our language of relationship. I mean, God's God, we're not. That's important. But God is transcendent in relationship. So you say, it's not that God is transcendent and in relationship. No, God is transcendent in relationship. God is never less than God in the relationship that God establishes with you. But let's take the word relationship seriously. I want you to think, in your mind's eye, think of a person who is close to you, closest to you maybe, and think about what that relationship is, and what would you, if you were asked to put on a piece of paper the basic characteristics of that relationship, what would it be? What would they be? Now let me, I was trying to work at this, and I'd be very happy to receive from you in writing, email, whatever, some additional characteristics. I'm going to give you five quick ones, and let's see how it connects with your own experience of relationship. One, God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to say. You got that person in mind? What if only one of you had something important to say? What kind of relationship would that be? It wouldn't be a relationship. So God, for the sake of a genuine relationship, gifts us with prayer. A prayer is a means by which we can have something to say in this relationship. And it's striking as you move through the text, if you were to go say to the Moses text, Moses, Exodus 3 to 7, and Moses is going back and forth with God as to whether or not to accept this call, you know, to lead the people of Israel. Moses finally comes up with 8 objections. They work with seminarians. Some of them get very close to 8, oftentimes by the time you get to the seminary. But it's that interact of God. God gifts us with a means by which we can engage God in a healthy communication. A second characteristic of relationship is that, and this becomes especially important in thinking about the environment, God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one with something important to do, and key, the power with which to do it. God is not the only one. God has entered into relationships. God has so entered into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to do, and with the power to do it. I'm very struck by the very first words in Genesis 1 to the newly created human beings. Get down on your knees and worship me. No, not at all. God doesn't go there initially. Very first words are, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue the earth, have dominion over the earth. The first words of God to the newly created human beings is, I'm giving you something to do and the power with which to do it. That's where God goes right out of the chute. Now just come back to the relationship that you have with somebody close to you. What if only one of you had real power? What kind of relationship would that be? It wouldn't be a genuine relationship. In order for the relationship to be genuine, both parties to the relationship have to have power. And God will so enter into relationships as to honor that characteristic of the relationship. And that will mean restraint and constraint in the use of God's power for the sake of a genuine relationship. Now, to put that more positively, could say this, God chooses to entrust us with responsibilities. God puts, we're not only to trust in God, yes indeed, God also places trust in us. Gives us those two responsibilities. It's risky for God to do that. But for the sake of a genuine relationship, I'm giving you something to do, and I'm giving you the power with which to do it, even though I know you may well misuse the power. A third is that God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one whose will comes into play. Again, think about the person with whom you're related. What if only one of you had a will that counted? What kind of relationship would that be? We speak rather glibly at times, and I'm astounded at the talk about the will of God that's out and about the church as I make my way around. Whatever God wills, God gets done. End of conversation. Everything that happens is the will of God. Some years ago, I did a study of God's anger in the Bible, and found that there are over 500 references to God's anger, either potential or actual. Now, if God's will always gets done, what's God doing getting angry so often? God, I must be getting angry at God's help somehow. That's what's going on. But God's will is resistible by the human will, and sin being sin against the will of God, Ten Commandments, it's a key point. Remember Jesus when he was entering into Jerusalem in the last week of his life, and he looked out over the city of Jerusalem, and he said, "How often would I have gathered you as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. You were not willing." So a fourth is that God so enters into relationships that God is deeply affected by what happens to the relationship. What kind of relationship would it be if God were never really affected by what happened to it? And oftentimes we got this God who seems, the image of your God is so indifferent, isn't really touched by anything. God doesn't have emotions, of course. God doesn't have emotions. Again and again, not only does God is provoked to anger, but God is disappointed. God is affected by our prayers. You need to think of, to use a big word, the affectivity of God, the affectability of God. God is genuinely affected by what happens to the relationship in this, to the creatures, and works in that relationship. And here we might talk about, without going into detail at this point, talk about God in relationship as both constant and changing. Certainly God's constancy, God is constant in relationship in terms of God will always be faithful to promises made. God will always will the best for you. God's love will be there for you through thick and thin. You don't have to ever wonder whether God loves you. God loves you. You can't evict God from your life. God will be present with you, come what may. Through thick and thin, God's core character will never change. At the same time, in order to be true to who God is, God's interrelational tactics, strategies, actions are going to be on the move so that God can truly relate to who you are and who you are becoming. And so we could get into topics here about law, for example, and how law changes in the Bible. When you move from Exodus to Deuteronomy, you get law which is on the move in view of changing people. Finally, let me say some things and open it up. If God so enters into relationships that God is genuine, that the future is not all mapped out. The future is not all mapped out. That the future is at least somewhat open. And I'm going to use a text here that's probably a foreign text to many people, but we don't get, it's not a lectionary text, and I've never heard a sermon or a Bible study on it, but maybe because it's so difficult, I don't know. Jeremiah 22, verses 1 to 5. And let me make a couple of comments about this. Thus says the Lord, go down to the house of the king of Judah and speak there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, O king of Judah, sitting on the throne of David, you and your servants and your people who enter these gates. Thus says the Lord, act with justice and righteousness, or substitute for that, take care of the environment. Act with justice and righteousness, and deliver from the hand of the oppressor anyone who has been robbed, and do no wrong or violence to the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place. For if, what's God doing saying if? For if you will indeed obey this word, then through the gates of this house shall enter kings who sit on the throne of David, who ride in chariots and in horses, and they and their servants and their people. But if you will not heed these words, another if from God, if you'll not heed these words, I swear by myself, says the Lord, that this house shall become a desolation. What people do makes a difference to the world, to what happens in the world. It's not somehow all mapped out. Sometimes I run into people who say, well, everybody's got their day, that's, you know, that they're going to die. And you have a close call, it wasn't my time, or whatever. I mean, how strange. You've got a specific time or a day out there, but your future's all set somehow. I mean, you don't have to take any precautions. You can do, take whatever risks you want. It's all set, that day is out there. I mean, it's really something to listen to that, and what the implications are if one has that understanding of things. Wouldn't you say, let's see, that even God's future is open to some degree? Notice, God says, if you do this, then this will be your future. If you don't do this, then this is going to be your future. And God's going to act in one way if that, they take that direction. God's going to act in another way if they take that direction. So in some sense, what we do affects not only the shape of the world, the shape of our life together, it helps shape the future of God. God will do things differently, to some degree at least, in view of what we do. And God's got then got the future, has not got the future all mapped out. This comment, some kind of an unqualified, sometimes an unqualified kind of language with regard to the future and God. Sort of, the future's in God's hands. Well, is it totally in God's hands? Ultimately, yes. Ultimately, the future's in God's hands. But we should be clearer that the ultimate future is in God's hands. The more proximate future is also in our hands. And what we do, not least with regard to the environment, what we do counts in shaping the future. What we do makes a difference, not only to the world, but to God. And so, come back. It's important with respect to the kind of God in whom you believe. What kind of God are you in relationship with? And think together about that is something I hope we can do this week. Well, we've got some time to open it up. Questions, comments? Please.
Regarding your last point, I love the text from Exodus where Moses comes down from the mountain and he sees the golden calf and God sees it and he's angry and he's going to kill everybody, all the Israelites. Yeah. And Moses gets down and says, you know, no, you created them, they're your creation. Why do you want to kill them? And he pleads and pleads and pleads. Yeah. And God changed his mind.
Yeah. You said that well. I like the energy there too, but that's good. That is a wonderful text. If you were to look up the verb change one's mind, it's the Hebrew word nakam, and it's used approximately 40 times in the Old Testament for God's either actually changing God's mind or God's potentially changing God's mind. This is not a minor theme. We could list the number of texts where that is drawn out. It's a fine example of how what people say is honored by God, is valued by God. And in view of what people say and do, God is going to move into a future that may be somewhat different. Thank you. It's an important text. Back there, I think.
Seems to me that how we look at God is more influenced by where we are rather than other factors.
Okay, say a little bit more about where we are.
The event horizon for people who are in a survival mode, their God is a God of survival. So, our God is different than, the way we look at God is much different than the way they look at God, I think.
I think I see your point. Let me say a couple of things here. Get into issues of suffering, near-death experience, survival experience, and images of God that so often emerge during such times. It's a major issue, I think. There are three sort of stages in one's life, speaking generally now, stages in one's life about which one might speak here. There are the, when you're not in the survival mode, when you're not near death, there's a way in which you can speak about God that helps prepare people for those moments when they will almost certainly come. Then there's the moment of actual being in the survivor mode, when near-death experiences, when you're grasping for any possible good signs for the future. Then, if you've been well prepared by your pastors, by your reading of the scriptures and so forth, for such moments, you're going to talk about God in that traumatic moment differently than if you've not been properly prepared.
I agree, but I'm talking about people that never get out of the survival mode.
Yeah.
People who are starving, don't have enough to eat, don't have a place to live.
Yeah.
How do they look at God?
Yeah, I think it varies a lot. I think that for many people, God is just an absentee landlord. That's the image with which many such people work, I think. And God's got other people who are God's favorites, and I'm not one of them. Hence, I'm destined to live through what I'm going through. There are a variety of such perspectives. I think one's one's the circumstances of one's life do shape how one thinks through God issues. But I would still at the same time want to say in such cases that the churches or the religious folk with whom those people have grown up with and prepared for have I think not worked with God issues as carefully as they might. And so when the folks get in that survival mode, they don't have the resources that they've been given, that they should have been given by the church to deal with it well. Yeah. Yes.
A friend of mine was a missionary, is a missionary, and was in Sri Lanka right after 9/11, right after the tsunami. And he had the opportunity to talk, because he spoke their language, with people from a range of religious perspectives. And all the perspectives that you've described came out in their understanding what happened in the tsunami. It was God in absolute control. It was God out of control. Whatever their understanding of God was. So it's an amazing array, spectrum of understandings. And where they came from is how they understood the disaster. So their reaction really confirms this spectrum you've laid out for us.
Okay. I think
the disaster is what did it.
Yeah, that's right. If you, we just celebrated not too long ago the 100th anniversary of the earthquake in San Francisco. And it's very interesting to go back and read the editorials, the newspaper columns and so forth that were printed in the wake of the San Francisco earthquake, and how common it was for people to think about this was a distinctly divine act directed specifically at people in San Francisco.
Right.
And so it's not something new. It's something that's been around for a long time, for sure. And the questions would be, how best might we work with the material? Yes, please.
I guess I would say, I already thought it before he said that, is that in this moment, or the starving people, that God does call on God's people to get involved, you know?
Yes.
That's when we hear the people who are starving, maybe we can ask ourselves, what have we done to promote that, or at least not to try to change it? And I think if it's a disaster, the fires in Oakland or the earthquake, we're called on to move in and be an extension of God's arm.
I think that's one very important way in which we can react at such moments. The question might be then, how do we work with all the other interpretations and explanations that are out there relative to what has occurred? We can't simply ignore those, the way in which people weave God into their understanding of these events. We need to address those issues. As I suggested earlier, it's very common for people to have been raised in a certain way with a certain understanding of God as God relates to disasters and other such matters. and they, that gets to be a part of their system, a part of who they are. And so at the dramatic, the traumatic moment, it's those perspectives that sort of emerge control, almost control their way of thinking about the moment. There's a third stage that one needs to think about here. There's the preparing people for such moments. It's working with people in the trauma itself. And then it's working with people in the aftermath of the trauma. Okay, they talked about God in such a way during the trauma. Let's come back. Let's not forget about the way in which they talked about God. That way of talking about God needs a little work. Let's work together on that and see whether or not there can be some clarifying language that can be introduced and so forth, so that the next traumatic moment can be experienced in a little bit more mature way with an understanding of God that's more biblical. Yes, please.
Another aspect of this, it seems to me, is that the church's teachings about the nature of God as for children sets the stage for a lot of people as they become adults and see the complexities of life and the way God, maybe they perceive God as failing them. It's an excuse to fall away from faith. That it gets to be we have a lot of friends who just don't believe in God anymore. Uh-huh. Because that kind of God doesn't work for them.
Right.
As they've gotten more sophisticated and you've gotten more sophisticated in understanding right. creation and everything, it's too simplistic. People believe in that kind of a God must be stupid. And I think that we do ourselves a lot of service by promoting a God that's more complex.
I couldn't agree more. Is that the church itself is responsible for a lot of folks leaving the church by the way in which they think about God and speak about God, not least in the context of trauma and disaster of one kind or another. I think there are a lot of people who are on the edges of church life, who live on the periphery of our congregations, or are outside together, have what I call a lot of church-caused scar tissue. Church-caused scar tissue, where they have experienced an understanding of God in the life of the church from varying folks within the church, and it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny in the midst of the trauma that the larger society is facing, the family is facing, the community is facing. We just need to recognize as a church that we are responsible, deeply responsible, for many of these perspectives. And, as you say, turning away from the church altogether that occurs. Yes, please.
It has been my experience of working in the ghetto in Chicago and then in Kazakhstan with the Volga Germans who had been in the gulags, in the labor camps, where many, many died. It put me to shame, their faith so deep and trusting in God. And one example, one of my one of the women to whom I spoke, she said, and that she was clinging on to the end, she said it was so desperate that once they were in these labor camps, in 45 when it was so cold in like Siberia sort of, in the Ural, up to the knees in water and no boots, nothing like that, and many, many died, and 50% the first year and then 35 the next. Anyway, she said once she was so desperate and she just put her, they had to cut trees in the Ural, these women did. The men were in concentration camps, something like that. And that she embraced the tree and then she said, Lord, I believe in you if you give me just one slice of bread a day. And that kept her going even now. She would call me sometimes and say, I'm at the end of my rope, can you come? When we were there, but she told me that kept her faith going. She had later on an alcoholic husband who was Muslim and abused her, and her son did the same. When I would give her money and she sewed it into a clothes, he would find it and use it for drugs and things, and he was abusive. But this, having experienced it, getting a slice of bread when she needed it kept her faith in God that he would see her through the end.
We should not forget your own participation in that ongoing ability of her to thrive and her relationship with God to continue. Yes. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.